Why do people believe in curses? For thousands of years, we've talked about curses. Curses passed down through the bloodlines. Everything goes wrong in my life. I've been cursed. My favorite sports team was cursed because someone didn't change their socks. Well, today we're going to talk with Dr. Ken Drinkwater and Dr. Neil Dagnall, giving us their years of research of why people believe in curses. Dr. Drinkwater, senior lecturer, researcher in cognitive and parapsychology at Manchester Metropolitan University, and Neil Dagnall, reader in applied cognitive psychology at Manchester Metropolitan University, will give us their scientific perspectives on curses. I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Please welcome to the Truth Be Told studios for the first time, Dr. Neil Dagnall and Dr. Ken Drinkwater. Happy, gentlemen.
Hi. Hi, Tony.
How are you both?
Very good, thank you.
Well, we are excited to have you here all the way from the UK, so thank you for staying up and doing the show with us.
Hey, that's no problem. Thanks for having us on.
Well, what we're going to do today is, I've told you before the show that I've had many people talking about curses on the show before, psychics, Wiccas, and shamans, and all kinds of different stuff. But we've never talked with psychologists about curses and what it really is and what, you know, because, I mean, how many of us have, I feel cursed. My life feels cursed. Everything I touch goes to crap. And I've heard, you know, curses going through the bloodline, and you have to sage your house and sage yourself to get rid of the curses. First of all, how did you both get involved in curses itself? Whoever wants to start.
Go on, I'll start then. One of the things is, Tony, is that it's part of the paranormal. So obviously, we've got an interest, and we do research that looks at people's cognitive abilities, cognitive processing that relates to belief in the paranormal. And I think that curses is just one of those extensions that we can consider. So it's a bit about what's the scientific perspective here? You know, why do curses have sort of rational explanations? So it seemed like a natural thing to move into. So we started to cover things, you know, related to belief in the paranormal and things like the anomalous and so on. But then belief in curses can arise from various ways, various means. So it might just be that people have different personalities, or they might have different thinking styles. So, and these are things that we've looked at in our cognitive research.
Well, how did you get started doing this field? Because going into psychology and seeing, you know, people's behavior, how did you get started in this actual field? Was there a significant situation that happened that led you in this direction?
I'll take that one, Ken. Well, actually, Tony, it started in quite a mundane way, because I'd always been very interested in the paranormal generally. So going back to the years of primary school, which in England is the years between 7 and 11, when I used to come home for lunch, there always used to be the amazing crest, you know. So even from a very early age, together with influences like watching his amazing feats, together with having a general interest in the paranormal, such as the emergence of Amityville, for example, and being gripped by that story as it actually unfolded as part of the book in the 70s, I had that interest. And then it was in the late 90s, we had a course at Manchester Metropolitan University, which was parapsychology. And the two people who were running the course, they left within a short period of time, which meant we had a choice. Either I took over the course or the course didn't run. So we had students who were interested. I had an interest. And then I jumped into that void. And then shortly after that, a few years later, Ken joined me on the course. And we've been teaching it ever since in various different guises.
What is parapsychology? Just so for the people out there that really don't know what that is.
It's the scientific study of experiences, really, and why they arise. And I suppose it's what we consider in principle to be sort of outside the realm of human capabilities.
Right.
So if we say it's a sixth sense, and people could talk about that, and we could try and investigate what that is, or, you know, the idea that it's conceived that goes beyond what conventional science is. So that's what it really is. That's what parapsychology is.
And what is that? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry. I was going to say that's the classic definition. Is it simply means beyond psychology. So it covers subject matter that wouldn't typically be within a psychologist's remit. So things like, as Ken said, ESP, remote viewing, psychokinesis, those sorts of parapsychological subjects are those that traditional psychologists and scientists wouldn't look at or would be loath to study.
So, okay, well, I want to get into that after a while once we talk about curses, because we've talked about the ESP and many times on my show, and even with what's his name? Ah, that's called a middle-aged memory fart. So curses. What are curses to you both? And are curses real?
I suppose, I mean, as I sort of alluded to at the start, I mean, it is about people's particular thinking styles around what curses mean to them. Right. So it's their interpretation of them. You know, what they mean to me, perhaps, is that they have rational explanations, or that people will ascribe certain things like supernatural powers to something that's a negative power or a negative event. And rightly or wrongly, it might influence the way they might make decisions. So to me, it's about how we sort of look at that. And, you know, they're interesting in their own right because of the number of films and programs and sort of stories you hear about. But I think it's interesting because of the way we consider the way we process, you know, what's, you know, effortful, something that's slow produces a rational thought. We might sort of say, actually, I can see where this is coming from. There's a connection with things that, you know, perhaps don't really make sense. But we are machines. We are things that we want to put the dots together. We want to create. We want to connect them. We want to find answers. So we do search for things. So sometimes we see connections and attribute things which perhaps aren't not correct. So from my point of view, it's interesting from a cognitive perspective.
Well, what connections in your research have you found that actually might give some validity to curses or superstition?
I mean, one of the things that you tend to find, Tony, is that when we're talking about curses, people often see them as being misfortune. They'll see them as being disastrous events.
Right.
So, for example, in England, we were talking about soccer before, and it's the same in the States. There's a number of clubs, for whatever reason, believe they're cursed. So, for example, because they're cursed, they go for decades without winning a major championship. So that's one form of curse, is that's often associated with sporting teams, where they have a sustained period of bad luck. And there's also curses, or hexes, if you like, that are associated with objects. So, for example, people who disrespect Robert the Doll, and figures, similar cursed objects, who have problems with the cursed objects. Because they've come into contact with that, they have bad luck, illness, that can even result in death. So the whole remit of what a curse is it varies across its context, but it's this idea that people are in some way fated, or there's some sort of agent that's guiding them towards something unpleasant. I think that's a sort of generic definition.
And what was popped into my head, I think it's funny that when it's negative, it's a curse. When it's good, it's a blessing. You know, it's like I've been blessed, or give me blessings, you know, send blessings my way. But when it's bad, it does. It's always a curse or a hex or a jinx, or they put that little spin on it. Who were some of the first people or research that you picked up when you started researching curses? Did you just like put an article in the paper and all of a sudden people said, I want to be a part of a study? Or how did you get the research to study this?
Well, one of the difficulties you often have, as we said when we started talking about parapsychology before, mm-hmm. is that because it isn't something that's typically researched by psychology, there's relatively few studies that are published on the topic. So, for example, one of the papers that I've been working on with a colleague from Spain is he did a paper on Ouija boards. And he did a search. You know, the idea that people who play with Ouija boards have misfortune, the Ouija board follows them, so they have all sorts of spooky events associated to Ouija boards. So it's quite an enduring idea. And he found, of course, believers had higher levels of anxiety from interacting in sessions than non-believers. So quite an obvious finding, but still interesting. But what we noted was there was relatively few papers done or very little research. And what was done tended to be more folklore-y. And that's one of the things that we found, isn't it, Ken, very often, that unless it's these core topics related to parapsychology, so for example, when you're looking at curses, there's not actually that much parapsychological research on it. Although what you can do is you can make it relevant to other things, such as the idea of supernatural forces or some sort of unknown agency driving people to have misfortune.
Well, it's funny is many people that, I mean, we've talked about Ouija boards where things have happened. It doesn't seem like it was just a coincidence when things, they call that the portal got opened because they messed with Ouija boards, or certain things that begin to happen just by believing in that something. So somebody cursed me, or I maybe open a portal when things start to occur. How would you explain that? Just saying, oh, you know, that's just a myth. But when things continually happens due to a Ouija board experience, or a Wicca experience, or you know, a witch put a curse on me, or you know, a family member put a curse on me. How do you explain that?
I mean, I'll just say something here. I think it's to do with the attribution, and I think it's to do with what it means to the people who are taking part. And, mm-hmm. and I was funny enough, before we came on, I was thinking a bit about the idea of religiosity, you know, that people will, you know, have a particular leaning one way or the other towards believing in religion or not.
Right.
And perhaps that plays a part in their own worldview, in the way in which they interact with these particular things. So, you know, obviously, if you think about the Ouija board, it was in the 1960s and 70s, it was sold as a game. It's a game for little Johnny to have as it for his birthday present, to just, you know, to use the planchette and to contact, you know, right. souls who no longer live here. And I think the thing is that part of it is that's been taken up by people that then actually it affects them in a particular way. So it could be their predisposition. Is there something that's triggering this? Is there, and I'm somebody that sort of looks at it and says that, you know, what can we eliminate here? And what we're left with is the anomaly. You know, sometimes things happen, but it's the interpretation of the events. So in paranormal speak, paranormal belief, people will believe in things because they think they've experienced something. And it's that experience that directly relates to their belief and their increase in the belief. So it's the same, I think, with curses and with objects and with, you know, summoning things through a Ouija board, or, you know, and having bad experiences might be the person's perception. Mm-hmm. But again, without going down the route of clinical and thinking about what perhaps is going wrong for some, you know, and not others, it's a difficult one, you know.
I mean, that is true, because I think... A lot of people go into their day, I guess, in a way that either somebody else has put a mood on them, or you woke up on the bad side of the bed, and versus I woke up in a really good mood, and oh my, you know, somebody let me in traffic, and I scratched a lottery ticket, and I won, and all my day just keeps getting better and better. But when you're in a bad mood, or you go into life saying everything I touch is terrible. And, you know, and then I got in a car accident, and then I, you know, I lost $1,000 at the casino, and, you know, it's like, see, there it is. That's my curse. You know, so it is a perspective, I think, in a lot of ways, because I think a lot of good things happen to us. It's just we don't notice it until we're in a mood to accept it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's spot on. I think part of it as well is about people's perception. And also sometimes people can be pessimistic, can be optimistic. So, you know, people could go through their lives being very pessimistic about things. And this brings me to something else. I mean, mentioned about research. We've looked at some research in the past by Wiseman and Watt, and they talk about measuring superstitious belief. And the idea that you've got the origin of superstitious belief, you know, it's the basis of psychological correlates of the way belief is formed. So, you know, that has a part to play. And maybe the way in which people consider, you know, having negative superstitions plays a part in this. So, you know, breaking a mirror causes bad luck. You know, you can have things that are also positive. So you might carry lucky charms to bring good luck. So these things are very important. But I think it's how we attribute and how we, you know, we make sense. Certainly. Sorry, Neil. You were going to say something. Sorry.
Thank you, Ken. Yeah. No, I think you're perfectly correct. I was just going to mention to Tony, Ken, the Derren Brown demonstration on his TV show.
Yeah.
Which I don't know whether people have seen that in the States, but they should. It may be on YouTube or one of the video channels. And what Derren Brown did was, he's a famous illusionist, sort of psychological manipulator, if you like. And he created the idea of a lucky dog in Todmorden. So he found that there was this dog in the park, and then he spread this story through Todmorden, saying it was lucky. And then what he found was, with secret cameras, people were actually going up to the dog, patting it, wishing it well. And then when something fortunate was happening, they then attributed that to the dog. You know, I had this good fortune because I patted the lucky dog in the park. And the other thing that he did, which was quite, you know, was really good, I thought, was he looked at two brothers. One of the brothers was happy-go-lucky and was associated with being very fortunate. The other brother, he was unlucky, or if you like, he didn't take opportunities. So what Derren Brown did was, he presented this chap with a number of opportunities, and he just overlooked them and missed them. So going back to what Ken said about pessimism, what that suggests is, it's if you have a pessimistic view of the world, then you miss opportunities, you fail to take chances if and when they arise.
Well, let me give you an example of what here, or not even just in Hollywood, of celebrity, about a curse. And just give me your perspective on this. So there's been many celebrities throughout the years, over in the UK and even here, that died when they were 28 years old. It's, you know, that, you know, Heath Ledger, Brandon Lee, you know, the list goes on and on and on. I think Amy Winehouse was 28. Mm-hmm. And they're like, oh, it's the, you know, celebrity 28-year-old curse death. Well, I mean, when people start thinking of that, I mean, especially if you're a celebrity, you're like, oh, God, am I next? But what do you think about when they talk about curses like that?
I think there's it's interesting because we start to put things together. We what we call patternicity. There's a certain, I mean, Michael Shermer makes this point very well, better than we can. I think he's a very clever chap. I think part of this is about, you know, how we put patterns together, and we've evolved that way, you know, in an evolutionary sense. And I think part of that is the tendency for some people perhaps to either search for a hypothesis that actually directly matches what they think about something, or it might be some sort of confirmation bias where they sort of think about, you know, and interpret and focus on a particular bit of information that confirms their preconceptions. So you could say that as people think about these people that seem to die at 28, we're not looking at people who die at 29.
I also think,
you know, that there's an element of randomness here. It's just the fact that we seem to know four or five of the people because they're in the spotlight, that it suddenly makes it more important. I think it's about belief bias. You know, there's an element of, you know, there's logical strength that sometimes comes about because of these things, and that presents a strength of argument. And then sometimes, you know, it's biased by the way in which people will then believe, you know, the conclusion that these people are dying at this age, and if mm-hmm. they become superstars, they're going to die, you know, and they're cursed. It's interesting, isn't it, how it gathers pace.
Can I just add to that, Ken?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think that's a really good point. All I was going to say was, again, drawing on soccer, so I do apologise to our American... but there are, if you go through the internet, Ken and I have done this quite recently, there are some really ridiculous curses. So, for example, one is to do with Aaron Ramsey, the footballer who plays for Wales. He did play for Arsenal, now plays for Juventus. So over here, he's a reasonably famous footballer. And what somebody had found was every time he scored a goal, a celebrity died. Hmm. So across the internet, there was this, there were memes about the curse of Aaron Ramsey. And when you think about it, he doesn't score that many goals, and there's a lot of celebrities. So the chances of him scoring a goal and somebody famous dying within a few days, if you look for the link between the two, is quite high. And as Ken said, it's that attribution, and it's putting those two together, looking for that pattern between these two unassociated events.
Yeah, that's a really good point, that, Neil. Can I just say one more, Tony, as well?
Yeah,
I was
please.
Thinking as well about something called, you know, when you have that sort of, I knew it all along. I knew right. it was going to happen.
Right.
You know,
right.
that kind of effect. Well, that's called hindsight bias. So basically, people have a tendency to see past events as being this sort of, it's a predicted thing, you know, at the time when those events happened. So all it does is just reinforces, you know, the nature of what they knew all along. It was going to happen. The person was going to die. Oh, they were 28. Oh, of course, they're famous. So just, right. they create, you know, and again, This is not that it's we're taking it lightly, because it can affect people as well. You know, I was thinking before about the problems that people might suffer from, you know, internal sort of triggers or perceived threat and problems with curses. And the fact that, you know, I think for some people it can be very difficult if they feel something's going against them and their lives aren't what they want them to be. You know, so it's difficult sometimes.
I mean, and this is almost connected to like conspiracy theory. I mean, I love a good conspiracy theory. But it does affect, you know, like curses. I think conspiracy theory nowadays even affect more masses than curses do, because it is a very psychological effect on people. I mean, all you got to do is say one thing and you know, they go down the rabbit hole way deep. And so same with curses. How does one reverse the curse? How do we do that? How do we change the mindset to, because even Sharon in the chat room says, if anything negative is near me, it seems sees me as a beam of light to annoy and try to take me down, yet I am still here winning. I mean, that's, to me, that's part of it, is saying I'm gonna win. But how do people change that mindset of saying, okay, I feel cursed, my family's cursed, everything we do, it just, we can't make it, da, da, da. But how do we change our mind? How do we change that mindset?
Well,
what
I was going to say was, one of the interesting ideas, and it's pertinent to superstition, is the idea that there's, if you like, passive behaviors. So you can be the recipient of bad luck, or you can do things to promote or ward off bad luck. So you can either be passive, the recipient, or you can actively engage in activities that potentially protect or ward off evil. So one of the things that people often do is they think that if they're cursed or if they have bad luck, they can engage in rituals, or they can perform various acts that they think will bring them good luck or stop something unlucky happening. So I don't know what you think, Ken.
Yeah, I was just thinking, just going back to what something you said at the start, actually, when before you asked that question there, Tony, it was the fact that the idea of the word for me that always sticks out is uncertainty, you know, and obviously you linked it to conspiracies. I think the nature of being uncertainty during uncertain times creates more, you know, decisions to make under mm-hmm. uncertainty, and people become more shall we say, more anxious.
Right.
And perhaps there's I'm not saying that everybody who becomes anxious is clinically anxious or there's problems with their lives, but coming back to what you said about how do people sort of change from the negative effects of these things? Well, I think it depends on the individuals. It depends how debilitating this might be, you know. So if somebody perhaps is misinterpreting things and it's affecting their lives, and obviously to seek some professional help. I mean, I think part of that is the severity of what's happening. Obviously, you're talking about, you know, your colleague and saying she has this beam of light, but she's still carrying on. I mean, suggests that she's having an association with certain things that seem to be problematic, but she's still resilient and she's still, you know, striving to achieve, and she is doing. So, you know, I think it's how we interpret these things. I mean, some people, to me, seem, I'm talking about superstition and luck. I mean, some people to me do appear to be rather unlucky. You know, I always say that because right. I always feel I'm rather lucky.
Right.
So, but I think that's a perception, isn't it? And it's an interpretation of the things that you go through in life. And sometimes you can put positive spins on things, just like we can put negative spins on. But I think it's the severity, really. And then depending on how that affects people, then trying to contact some counselling or I'll take it further.
You know, I mean, conspiracy theory, like I'll just touch a little bit back on that. As a conspiracy theorist, I mean, we touch on it with Truth Be Told. That's not my show, but we touch on it. But there are some truth to many conspiracy theories. And like somebody said in the chat room, this is, I'm just giving you guys a chance to explain your side. It says, are they going to say that or convince people that curses don't exist? You can't prove the non-existence of anything. So how do you prove that curses don't exist? You know, because there's a lot of mysteries out there that we really can't explain, and even conspiracy theories that are like, oh, that's so far-fetched, and then 5 years from now, it's going to go, oh, that was true. So how do you say that that curses don't necessarily exist?
Can I start there, Ken? And then you
yep.
can add. Well, one of the things that we hope that the if people look at what we've done, I hope they appreciate that Ken and I are by no means debunkers. I mean,
right.
we've always adopted this very straightforward line of we're interested in why people are, for example, feel they've been affected by curses. Now, whether curses exist or not, I think is a separate question, because we're more interested in the impact it has on individuals,
right.
the impact it has on people generally. And then what we can do is we can look at the sorts of psychological factors, because we are psychologists,
right.
that are associated with belief in curses, belief
nice.
In the supernatural, etc. But we're not there to debunk. There are in the UK people who are called anomalistic psychologists, and they start off from the premise that paranormal phenomenon, supernatural, doesn't exist, and that it can be explained by relatively mundane psychological explanations. Now, some of those are very, very reductionist and very simplistic. So if you like, whether it exists or not, very often to Ken and I is incidental, because we're interested in the human impact and the sorts of psychological factors that are associated with it. But we're also open to the idea that there might be something more going on.
Nice. What about you, Dr. Ken?
Well, I think that's spot on. I mean, I always use the term compassionate skeptic, but I get ribbed for using that term all the time. But you know, I'm a skeptic, but I think I'm not 100% skeptical. I mean, and I'm not debunking either. So I think in the context of it, it's trying to eliminate those things within any particular type of paranormal, you know, mm-hmm. phenomena that we can remove. You know, so there's certain things, you know, maybe it's just a trick of the lights, whatever. And then you're left with what's anomalous, what's the anomaly, you know, and then that's the thing that's interesting. But, you know, like Neil said, we're actually interested in looking at sort of the human condition and the cognitive processing. And why do people believe in these things, you know,
right.
and it's not, we're not there to tear it down. I think the other thing as well about curses and about conspiracies is it's sometimes about the ideas and sometimes it's about, you know, what makes people believe in these things, because mm-hmm. belief plays a part in this, you know, and people can find lots of information on the internet. And of course, where does the information come from? And is the information accurate? And one of the things is that people might read a particular newspaper and believe what the broadsheet or the newspaper says. And you take a particular stance, and that could be that this is a political stance, whether you're red or you're blue, depending on you're conservative right. or you're not. So you have all these different parameters, and sometimes if you believe, say, in a conspiracy, it can lack evidential support, and sometimes it's resistant to falsification. So, you know, research has been looking at that in conspiracies, but less so in curses. It's not the same, but it shares similar things. And as Neil was saying before, it's not been researched very heavily, curses, where we've done more research in conspiracy theories.
Have you, I mean, I'm sure you have heard of Mercury retrograde, right?
Vaguely.
So,
remind us.
So Mercury retrograde is usually 3 times a year. Sometimes, very rare, it's 4 times a year. It usually lasts about 3 weeks at a time. It's when Mercury slows down. And this is according to, you know, the astrologers and they talk about how when it slows down, the communication and technology can start getting mixed up. So, you know, and I never used to believe it until this is kind of really goes into a curse, because it's like, I don't really believe it. I think that's just a bunch of bull. But, you know, when your car breaks down in those 3 weeks, and then your computer won't start and you have to get it fixed, and then you drop your phone and you break your phone, and it's like in these three, and then the 3 weeks is over and nothing goes wrong for the next until the next cycle of Mercury retrograde. So when you see those coincidences, and especially when you don't even believe, it's like, I don't even believe in it, but all of a sudden you're like, wait a minute, that happened. And then it's over, and then it's like, oh, it stopped. Everything went back to normal. How do you, like, if you were skeptical, which you sounds like you are, and I think it's great to have a little skepticism with anything, yeah. just because there's a lot of truth to things, but there's a lot of, like I always say, fish stories, you know, when, you know, your grandpa went fishing, he caught a 2-pound bass, and then 10 years later it was a 10-pound bass. So the stories get a little bit more enhanced. But how do you explain something like that in the mind that's like, I don't believe it? Or did you just subconsciously think, well, maybe this is going to happen, and it just starts happening? I mean, that's where when you see things that happen in a period of time, you're going, wait a minute, there's something to this.
Yeah, no, I think we all experience that. I mean, I think because one of the things I mentioned before is that it's this patternicity. I think that we evolved into humanoid, you know, to a species that actually searches for things to put them together, because we're very good at that, you know. And I think that we can find that something connects to something, and we can make connections.
Right.
I think it's. It's not that these things, you know, I'm not saying that Mercury, you know, that isn't affecting, you know, equipment and isn't affecting, you know, some people's daily lives. But, you know, I think it's the fact we can find these things to actually back up what we actually right. think is happening. You know, so in some regards, like I was saying before, it's that sort of, you know, there's a certain bias sometimes, you know, or, you know, perhaps there's a tendency to overestimate, you know, the influence that things have. And that's called an illusion of control. You know, and I also think that there's many different ways, you know, in terms of psychology, when you think about it, that we all do. We're all suspect. We're all open to these things. But it's, you know, one person might be closed, might be more closed, and sort of say these things. It's all, you know, black and white. It, only A plus B equals C.
Right.
There's no, you know, randomness, you know.
Yeah,
where,
I was,
you know, in world, there is randomness. Sorry, Neil, go on.
I was just going to say exactly the same point, Ken, which is we end up in this idea of being binary, don't we? We're either believers or non-believers.
Yeah.
So right. people who are very open to belief will very often see us as being non-believers. And it's very easy to see the world in terms of contrasts, in terms of black and white. Well, as you said to me, you know, you'll say to me, oh, you're quite superstitious, Neil, in many respects. And I think that's that what Tony was talking about before, not believing but still having an unease about things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's very easy for me to sit here and make fun of Robert the Doll, but if I visited Robert the Doll in the museum and he's there in the case And there's all these anecdotal stories, all these witness statements of people who've had misfortune because they've been rude to Robert the Doll. Then I'm not sure I would be rude to Robert the Doll, even though I don't believe. I'd still be open to the idea that, well, I'm not going to tempt the fates. And I think part of that is because no matter how scientific we are or try to be, most people have an openness to a receptivity to things unknown, if you like. And I think that's an adaptive response, because if things are likely to be dangerous or if things are likely to cause us potentially harm, why would we want to engage with them? We want to avoid things that are likely to end up in negative circumstances. And the other thing that we also need to think about is that people are not always stable. And I don't mean that in a clinical way. What I mean is there's a series of events that can happen. So you can start off not believing in something, and then something unfortunate happens, and then something unfortunate happens, and something unfortunate happens. And then at that point, suddenly you start, well, please God, help me do something and that was captured beautifully. I don't know if you ever saw it, Tony, in the series Battlestar Galactica, where Boltar was put through a series of trials by the Cylon because he questioned why this modern, highly advanced civilization believed in gods. And then right at the end of it, when all these horrible things have happened to him, that's when he pleads for God's help.
Oh, I used to love that series. Not the newer. I don't think I watched the newer one, but the original version. I'm a very superstitious person. Not very, but I am superstitious. I remember when I was in sports, I would do the same breakfast. I would wear the same socks or underwear or whatever it was. And, you know, through college, I was that way. And even now, I'm very much of a routine person when it comes to I love going to casino. I'm just a casino person. And I like to go the same route, to play the same machines. If I win, I'm like, that's where I'm going. But I remember interviewing this gentleman. I can't remember his name, but it was about winning in Vegas. And he says he actually put a study together, and it was a group of people, and the intention was to win as a group. And so when they went, he said, I can't remember the way they did it, but it was like this prep time, you know, of meditation and you know, putting good intentions to each other. And they said that almost every single person won something of significance. And because he goes, when you go in with significance, not just like, I hope I win, but it was more like, I'm going to win. And it's kind of like the same thing, you know, like I'm going to have a good day. You know, the universe is going to treat me amazing. I deserve this. So I think it is, intention does help us through our life and day, you know, because a lot of people do get up and it's going to be a terrible day. I'm, you know, today's going to suck. I got to go to work, and then I got to go to a birthday party. And, you know, and so we just get in that mood. But I do believe that people can have curses, but I believe people can change it. I really do. I really do believe that people can change their out. And somebody said in the chat room about karma. It's very similar to karma. They said, well, can curses really be kind of a mixture of karma? What do you think on that? What is your feeling on karma? Do you think karma is real, or do you believe that is just a subconscious saying, I did this to somebody and I deserve something bad to happen?
Well, it's funny you should say that. I was just thinking of my mum. My mum no longer with us, unfortunately, but she was somebody who really believed in karma.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she did. And she was somebody that sort of talked a lot about that with God and these things. And, you know, if you do good things, well, that will come round. A bit like pay it forward, you know, that idea. The fact if you're doing good things and therefore you're going to be rewarded.
Right.
and bless her. You know, I mean, whether she was naive, did it really work? But it depends, doesn't it, on how you see your life and how you interpret the, mm-hmm. the things that, that go for you. So sometimes it can be, like I said already, you know, I feel I'm quite a lucky person. So things tend, in my life, I tend to have preferable, you know, profitable things and good things happen. But is it because I'm making them in my mind and seeing them as positive? You know, that, that I don't always see the negatives. I see the interaction, you know, a conversation, meeting people as being positive, or other people might not see that. They might just see that as problems,
right.
And people get problematized. So I think it depends, doesn't it? It depends on the person. And, you know, I'm sure that people can change, because it's a bit like learning. People learn to do certain things, and sometimes when it almost goes wrong, you can unlearn those processes and you can learn new ones. I mean, in psychology, that's what people can do, you know.
Well, before, we only have about 10 minutes left, and I really want to touch on something we talked about earlier, is like ESP. Have you guys done any research, you say, that on ESP? Because I think this is very fascinating, because this is another subject where it can't be just a coincidence that some people have the knowledge, you know, like really good psychics that know information that they would never know, or being able to read somebody's mind or move objects or whatever it is. As psychologist, do you believe this, the mind itself has that power to do those type of things?
Neil, do you want to take a punt?
I think it's really difficult, because there's, when you look at the evidence, there are many studies that have found positive results. So, for example, we did a media piece, and it was heavily edited, and the editor made it quite negative and anti-psychic.
Right.
So consequently, I got an email from Daryl Bemp saying, I hope you're aware, Neil, that there's plenty of studies that have demonstrated that ESP exists. And I replied saying, yes, thank you, Daryl, but there are also many studies that have pointed out it doesn't exist. And the article we produced was heavily edited. And that's why it has that flavour to it. So I think what I'm trying to say in a long passion is, it's quite a contentious subject, and I don't think people come to it in an open and objective way. So if Ken and I start off with the premise that the evidence could suggest to us ESP exists, then we would start to perhaps look at it in a different way from people who disbelieve. So there's a body of evidence for, there's a body of evidence against.
Right.
The way in which it's published, the way in which it's interacted, unfortunately, isn't done in an objective fashion very often. And consequently, people allow their inherent biases to affect the way they interpret things.
Mm. Mm. I mean, what I'll say, Tony, as well, is that recently we've done some research interviewing people who say that they're psychics, mediums, sensitives, intuitives. And it's fascinating to hear their experiences, and also, you know, the idea that I'm trying to understand more about the world that they embrace. You know, I don't [S2] Right. [S1] Claim to be psychic, but understanding a bit more about, say, what the phenomena is, mm-hmm. So the subjective paranormal experience and how that can be looked at through a qualitative approach. I mean, a lot of the research we do is quantitative, but doing qualitative, I think, just gives you that connection, and you can hear, you know, people's experiences of how they channel, or how they, you know, they speak to the dead, or how they contact something and then they pass information through a reading. I mean, there's lots of different ways that and categories. So it's a vibrant world to be part of.
Have you? I mean, I'm sure you've heard of remote viewing.
Yeah.
And somebody in the chat room was saying to learn the skill of remote viewing, wondering what they think of that program. Have you? Go ahead.
Sorry, I was going to say, I know there are different programs. I mean, I've heard, I'm sure, of the Monroe Center is one of them, but I think there's people who are training as psychics, mm-hmm. as psychic mediums, and they're training people to do remote viewing. And I think, you know, again, it depends, doesn't it, on how, what your take is on that. And when you go to these courses, what is it they're actually getting you to tune into? And you know, whether they're channeling something, or they're focusing some visual processing that's, I mean, some people believe in presentiment, and they talk about sort of, you know, the idea of a sixth sense or a seventh sense. So the right. idea that there's a remote sort of part that they can tune into across time and space. I mean, people, you know, examining that, and you know, why not?
I mean, some of the results that people like Targ and Puttock produced were quite impressive, but then later on, when people like David Marks interrogated them, he started finding loopholes in the sorts of protocols that people had given with regards to their remote viewing accounts, didn't he, Ken?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah, I consider myself, because I work with a lot of psychics, and I consider myself somebody that, like I said, has a little skepticism on a lot of things. But when it comes to psychic abilities, I believe, again, everybody has an intuition. And so definitely I believe that that can be enhanced. I've seen people that I've heard, you know, they've had a near-death experience, or they got struck by lightning, or something happened to them that their intuition was way farther advanced once they experienced one of those things I just spoke about. What's it called when you're just very sensitive? And I, like I said, another middle-aged brain fart, but you're very sensitive and you can feel people's energies. I definitely am that type of person. I can almost instantly feel when somebody is not, their intentions aren't good, and I will pull back, and then weeks later somebody will be like, oh my God, that person was not a good person. So, I mean, I definitely feel that I have some of that ability. I'm not one to go, oh, I can read your mind, I can read your future and see your past, but I believe all of us have that intuition. And do you think that then we got to get out of here, and I'm going to have you back. We'll have to talk more about this stuff. But do you
think, yeah, great.
Do you think there's exercises for us to do to enhance our abilities when it comes to not just positivity, but to enhance our intuition to protect ourselves from negative energy or just negative thought or whatever you want to call it? What can we do to change that? Is there a way to do that ourselves?
Sorry, Tony, that's a really good question. I mean, I was just thinking straight away of meditation and sort of things like that, where you can help yourself become more sort of relaxed and sort of in tune with things. I mean, I've heard lots of psychics talk about meditation,
right,
and being prepared before they do their their contact or their spiritual reading or whatever. I suppose in terms of improving the intuition part. I suppose it's a bit, I don't want to talk about conspiracies again, but in the context of it, it's trying to be more open to the fact that not everything you read is going to be true. It's learning a bit more about, the nature of, say, fake news, or,
right,
perhaps it's perhaps being a bit more, I don't want to say, again, more sceptical, perhaps, not being disbelieving, but perhaps asking more critical questions. And sometimes, the veracity and the validity of where information comes from. But it's a really good question. I don't know what you think, Neil.
Well, what I was going to say is it's slightly different, Ken, but related to that. And one of the things we've always been interested in, as I said before, is factors that are associated with belief. And not in a pejorative, negative way, in the sort of way that you've been talking about, Tony. So one of the things we might look at is schizotypy. Now, schizotypy, people argue about whether it's an attenuated form of schizophrenia or whether it's a personality domain that shows some similarities. Now, I've always looked at that as a very positive thing, because as Ken's no doubt told you before I arrived, I can be very black and white about the world. I can be very, I try to be like Mr. Spock. I try to be
logical,
very much so, this is how things are, this is how they need to be, this is how we progress. And one thing I'd love to be is much more open-minded. And I see things like schizotypy and cognitive perceptual differences and having unusual sensations and being open to other forms of consciousness as being potentially liberating. But unfortunately with me, it doesn't, because I'm so stuck in my ways, it's very difficult to do that. So going on to what Ken was saying, I did try some mindfulness training because I had a student who was doing a project on mindfulness. So I recorded all the mindfulness tapes, got interested in it, and tried some of the relaxation techniques. And all it did was make me more anxious. So I spoke to one of the counselling people, and I said, is it common for people actually to find relaxation stressful? And he said, yeah, some people are like that.
I do think that's funny how, like, you know, me and my brother are complete opposites. We're, you know, we grew up the same, same parents, in the same environment, but yet, you know, I'm more of a optimistic, you know, go out, I can do whatever, if I put my mind to it, and then he's complete opposite. It's like, how did that happen where, you know, that mindset is completely different. And you're like, but oh, okay, you know, I can't. But then I'm like, I'll just move on. That's his life, and I'll do mine. how do people find you? Because, you know, we're unfortunately run out of time. But how do people find you? I know your article. I'm going to put it in the chat room. But how do people find out more about you and your upcoming work?
Obviously, the first thing is that they can go to the website for Manchester Metropolitan University, and they can search for us as tutors on there. They can see some of the papers we've produced, and they can find details there. They can also go to The Conversation. I mean, The Conversation is a piece. We've produced several articles on The Conversation, and any comments about the pieces we've produced. Obviously, as Neil said, with the editors, sometimes the editors, they ride roughshod over what we've written. So it's
right.
not really our... they change it. So anyway,
they make it very critical, Ken, and then people blame us for being very critical.
Oh, I know. I'm holding my hands up saying I didn't write it like that. Sorry, no. So
they're like, sure you didn't.
Yeah, you're just saying that, Ken. Yeah, right. I am. Yeah, of course I am.
It's like, when I like it, you wrote it. When I don't like it, you didn't write it. What's what's going on?
Yes, and there's things like that. I mean, also, I think we've got, I think I put on an email to you, I think I've got, there's a Facebook account, and you can find us on Facebook. If you just typed in our names, you should be able to find us, or Twitter. So,
well, people in the chat room are saying, great show, and we appreciate you both, Dr. Ken, Dr. Neil. Thank you so much for coming on the show, and we'll have to have you back for a more in-depth discussion about other topics.
I'm quite happy to talk more about conspiracies, Tony.
Don't tease me. Don't tease me, because we will.
JFK is my favorite subject. Sorry.
Oh, see, JFK, Marilyn Monroe, all that, Bobby Kennedy. Yeah. Oh, well, we haven't had that on for a while. So now, next time, you'll have to come back and be a part of it.
I've still got the injunction out, Ken.
Thank you. Yes. Anytime, Tony. I'm ready. I could do it tonight.
Okay. Right. Yeah. We'll wait till after midnight. Gives a little more.
Okay.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for being part of the chat room and asking some questions. And as always, please share and leave a great comment. Like this show, if you don't mind. And until next time, I'm Tony Sweet with Truth Be Told. Go to all of our social media outlets and our website, and you're going to see it right after this on our closing credits. Talk to you soon. Bye-bye.